to order, and I'm going to open a work session for the possible reconsideration of House Bill 2121 and the amendments. Representative Dalto.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2121 and the amendments.
Representative Dalton moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2121 and the amendments. Is there any discussion?
Should I do a roll call vote or just voice?
Okay. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the rules are suspended for the purpose of reconsideration of House Bill 2121 and the amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westland.
I move the committee reconsider House Bill 2121.
Mr. Chair, can I add on to Representative Westland's motion?
Yes.
I move that we reconsider the vote, which House Bill 2121 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay. Representative Westland and Dalto, as a tag team.
As so often happens.
Move that we reconsider the vote by which 2121 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I voted no on this bill earlier, and I will be voting no again. I've heard from my county, which does not approve of this, and they feel that it's unnecessary. And we heard from people who testified last week that it was already being done by the commission and that this wasn't necessary. And I'm also concerned about the fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Representative Westland?
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2121 with the two amendments be adopted.
Okay. Representative Westland moves we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2121-2 amendment be adopted. Is that right? Are we on track here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay. We're backing out, folks. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. And now we need a similar motion on the Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2121 with the Dash 1 amendment to be adopted.
Representative Westland moves we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2121-1 amendment be adopted. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. So now we're back to square one. So I would entertain a motion to move the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2121 with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a subsequent...
No, you're just moving the Dash 1 amendments at this point.
I love those Dash 1 amendments, Mr. Chair. I recommend that they be incorporated into the bill.
Representative Westland moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2121. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. I would entertain a motion on the Dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2121.
Representative Westland moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2121. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And committee, we now have a Dash 3 amendment, which should be in your packet.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 3 amendments address the issues that were raised last week in with the concerns around the federal funding. You'll remember the Dash 2 amendments specifies that the Department of Community Colleges and the Workforce Development use federal funds as they are available. The Dash 3 amendments are specifying even further the effective date to allow for the federal funding issue to be secured and evaluated. So the effective date is of this bill would be July 1, 2005.
Chair would entertain a motion on the dash 3. Representative Westland.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2121.
Representative Westland moves the dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2121. Any discussion? Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Dalto.
Are we ready for a motion?
We're ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2121 to the floor with the amendments 1 through 3 with a... Well, I move House Bill 2121 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a do-pass recommendation, including the amendments we just considered.
Representative Dalto moves House Bill 2121 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Excuse.
No.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2121, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2121 and open a work session on House Bill 2244. Sandy, where are we?
Mr. Chair, 2244 had a hearing the end of January. This is the bill that allows the Department of Human Services to charge fees for certain authorized users of the Department's Immunization Registry Information Systems, also known as the ALERT system. As you recall, we talked about the background of the Immunization Registry, the current funding mechanisms, the confidentiality issues, and there was raised some concerns about the definition being too broad for authorized users. The Dash 1 amendment specifies or clarifies even further what an authorized user is, and it also exempts people or entities that would not be impacted or required to take a fee while using a registry. The Dash 1s, you should have a hand engrossed copy of the bill. Nobody contacted me as far as testifying on the bill or the amendments, so I'm not sure if there are any issues. The department has seen it and has seen it one of these.
Okay. any discussion on this bill? I think the issue has been addressed in an appropriate fashion. So it would be the chair's intent to move the bill unless there are any concerns or questions from the committee. And this also goes to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Hmm? Yeah. May I question that, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
I thought from my notes that there was not a fiscal impact.
It is a fee bill, Representative, and all fee bills, by direction of the co-chairs, need to go to Ways and Means.
Got it. Thank you.
Any other discussion or questions? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll. Oh, excuse me. Excuse me. I'm a little ahead of myself. Maybe a motion would be appropriate here. I don't know. Representative Parker.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2244 be moved with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barker moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2244. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Now, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion for House Bill 2244 with the amendments we just discussed to be forwarded to Ways and Means with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2244 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Now, Mara, you may call the roll.
Representative
Anderson?
Aye.
Representative
Parker?
Aye.
Representative
Dalton?
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
House Bill 2244, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2244 and open a work session on House Bill 2566. Sandy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2566 had a hearing first March 3rd. It is back before us with the dash 2 amendments. You will remember that this was the bill that requested the Department of Education to grant awards for the automated external defibrillators in public school facilities. The dash 2 amendments, which are, if you have the dash 1, which I'm not sure if you do, if you don't, then we won't talk about it because the dash 2 combines the dash 1s. It specifies that any grant received, well, if any school district that applies for a grant, that the grant be allowed in 60% of the actual amount requested. It's allowing the Department of Education to seek federal funds for the grants, and it eliminates the language for general fund appropriation. And these were Representative Hass's amendments, and he has seen them and is supportive of them. This, too, has a reference to Ways and Means, by prior reference.
Any discussion? The chair would entertain a motion on the dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2566.
Representative Tomei moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2566. Any discussion on the dash 2 amendments? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2566 to the floor. Oh, do we have to refer it to Ways,
yes,
and Means? To Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2566 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, call the roll.
Representative Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2566, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2566 and open a work session on House Bill 2517. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, this bill directs the Department of Human Services to accept the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or the CMS, billing, reimbursement, and reporting forms instead of department forms if the federal forms contain substantially the same information as required by department forms. The department is moving towards this. This also puts us on the same track as the new HIPAA regulations that are going to become effective in April, and there are no amendments to this bill.
And there are no objections from the department, and this just codifies the direction we're already headed. And is there any discussion? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2517 be carried to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson moves House Bill 2517 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. I would entertain a motion for consent calendar. Representative Anderson so moves. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. House Bill 2517, having received the required majority, is declared passed and placed on the consent calendar. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2517. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2684. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2684 is brought forward to the committee after request of the Oregon Academy of Audiology, the Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association. The bill is exempting audiologists and physicians from being hearing aid dealer license requirements.
Okay. So, Wendy, Genoa, and Duane. good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Thank you. Are you wearing green?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I did bring my legislative chair with me, and it's his birthday today, so I think that should count for something.
and I'm not wearing green, so I'm going to be forced to carry this pair all day. But,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Genoa Ingram, representing the Oregon Academy of Audiology, and with me today, to my right, is Wendy Chapman, who is president of the Oregon Academy of Audiology, and our legislative chairman to my left is Wayne Anderson. I wanted to thank the committee for accommodating our schedule. The bill was originally scheduled for last Friday, and Mr. Anderson contributes a portion of his time to rural hospitals on Fridays, every other Friday, hospitals that do not have access to audiologists, and unfortunately was unable to make it, so we appreciate the committee's indulgence. As you've heard from staff, current statutes prohibit both physicians and audiologists from dispensing and fitting hearing aids without the license, for being licensed as a hearing aid dealer, even though both have licenses under separate boards. I have laid out for you in my written testimony, which I plan just to summarize for you, the requirements in the second paragraph for a hearing aid dealer. The third paragraph outlines for you the requirements for an audiologist. I wanted to go into that very briefly. An audiologist must, at a minimum, hold a master's degree or its equivalent in the area of speech, language pathology, or audiology, submit a minimum 275 clock hours of supervised direct clinical experience, present evidence of a minimum of 9 months post-education professional employment with a licensed or certified audiologist supervisor, and pass an examination approved by the Oregon Board of Examiners for Speech, Language, Pathology, and Audiology. Licensing fees consist of a $30 examination fee and a $100 initial fee and renewal fee. Licenses must be renewed on a biennial basis and by January 30th of every even-numbered year. Currently, the continuing education requirements are 30 clock hours of demonstrated professional development, although effective on January 31st of 2004, that goes up to 40 clock hours. I might point out that the license fee for the hearing aid dealer is a $50 exam fee and then a $200 initial and renewal fee, which is renewable every year after that. I wanted to point out, too, that several sessions ago, the legislature formed a task force to examine the possibility of consolidating these two boards. In its summary findings, the task force concluded, I'd like to quote, there does not appear to be any perceived common thread between speech-language pathologists, audiologists, and hearing aid dealers. Main functions that audiologists perform are not shared by hearing aid dealers in the delivery of the services to the public. The conclusion of that task force was that they voted unanimously not to consolidate those two boards. Obviously, the primary concern for you, the legislature, in this matter should be the matter of consumer protection. And in the course of their duties, the audiologists must dispense or find themselves in a position to dispense a wide variety of prosthetic devices to assist in the ability of their patients to hear. And the code of ethics, as provided by the administrative rule and statutes, require that they be proficient and knowledgeable in distributing these devices, that they may not distribute these devices unless they have knowledge that it will help the patient, and they must be knowledgeable in how the devices will work. And you'll hear Mr. Anderson in a few minutes go into greater detail about that. We feel that the consumer protection provisions, which I've attached to the back of my testimony, provide more than adequate provisions for the protection of these patients. However, if after listening to all the testimony, the committee feels that additional consumer protection provisions are needed, we are certainly open to those discussions. I wanted to point out as well that you probably have before you the fiscal impact on this bill, which reflects a minimal fiscal impact, and I would like to just address just a moment how we arrived at that situation. We were, of course, very, very sensitive in this atmosphere, not having a large fiscal impact on the board. As you will probably hear, there are approximately 137 audiologists who, my mic just went out.
adjusted?
No, they're adjusting it. Don't worry about it. It was a little bit big, so now it's better.
Okay. There are approximately 137 audiologists who are licensed as hearing aid dealers, and we were concerned that if all 137 pick up their licenses and went away, that would have a devastating effect on the board. And we merely wanted to set a policy. So we discussed this in great detail about leaving some incentives there for individuals who were audiologists to possibly maintain a second license. And there are some incentives for audiologists to do that. There was a meeting a couple of months ago in Eugene where we took a vote that if this bill were passed and leaving these incentives mirrored in the hearing aid dealer's license and not the audiology licenses, how many of you in the room would continue to maintain the second license? And the result was about 98% indicated that the law being as it is current or left as it is currently, that they would probably maintain both. For example, if a patient returns a hearing aid device, the individual license as a hearing aid dealer under current law is allowed to keep approximately 20% of that cost, even if it's returned. That incentive is not mirrored in the audiology license. Now, there is legislation being considered that would allow that amount to be set by rule rather than the flat 20%, but that is one incentive that we believe would prod some individuals to keep the second license. Also, there is a provision that if a patient is going to return a hearing aid device, that it must be done within 30 days. Once again, that provision is not mirrored in the audiology regulations. And so for those reasons, as well as others, we think that there will be some incentives in place for people to keep the second license. And at least in the immediate future, we won't see a huge impact on the board. And our primary reason for bringing the bill forward at this time is really a question of equity. The audiologists are required to maintain and pay for two separate licenses, and we just feel that that is not necessary given the qualifications of the audiologists, given the requirements under both their statute and their very, very strict administrative rules. We feel that the licensing and the continuing education requirements more than adequately encompasses all of the consumer protection requirements needed. And again, if the committee feels that there are additional consumer protection provisions that need to be added, again, we are very willing to listen to those. Many years ago, when I worked for the Legislative Research Committee that no longer exists, we used to staff the Joint Interim Committee on Sunset Review, and one of the things that I used to hear when I worked for that committee that came up over and over again when these licensing boards came up for renewal were the words turf battle. This is a turf issue. This is a turf issue. And I would just like to address that very briefly. We feel really it is a matter of equity that the audiologists are currently paying to support a board that really, and I have not been able to find any to quantify these figures, but they really don't look at that many complaints against audiologists. So from the conversations that I've had, that I've heard the words, very few, if any, complaints against audiologists are examined by the Hearing Aid Council. We just feel that because they derive a minimal benefit that they should be allowed to work under their own license. Furthermore, the hearing aid dealers often conduct tests, or they have to conduct tests in the fitting of their the fitting of hearing aids, and the audiologists have never at any point ever suggested that they have to have an audiology license to do that. So we are not in any way trying to impact how the hearing aid dealers operate or conduct their business. Once again, we're merely asking that the audiologists be able to operate under their own bill or their own board. And then finally, in conclusion, this committee heard back in February House Bill 2325, and that was the bill, among other things, that changed the name of hearing aid dealer to hearing aid specialist. The Oregon Academy of Audiology did not oppose that legislation. In fact, we feel it may be time for this particular profession to emerge and support its own board and be its own true profession and not have to be supported with the assistance of the audiologists.
I just want to thank you for your time and your consideration, and I'll be happy to answer questions either now or at the conclusion of testimony.
Okay, let's
keep moving. All right. My name is Dwayne Anderson, and I've practiced audiology since 1955. In 1961, I was employed by the Oregon State Health Division as an audiologist to manage the statewide hearing testing program for children. In my 21 years at the Health Division, I also served as administrator of the hearing aid dealer's law. I prepared the written and practical examinations and hired audiologists to administer the exam. I was responsible for managing all the consumer complaints and including follow-up communication with both the hearing aid dealer and the consumer. In other words, I did everything. In 1973, after the licensure law for speech pathologists and audiologists was passed, the job of executive secretary to the board was added to my duties, and I left the Health Division in 1982. In 1959, Oregon passed the first hearing aid dealer registration law in the country. It was truly a milestone for Oregon, since the industry made for Oregon. The industry made a huge effort to cause its defeat, and the state legislature at that time did the right thing in spite of the pressure. It is well known that the parents of deaf and hearing impaired children, along with a group of fearless audiologists, developed a grassroots campaign here in Oregon to effectively get the law passed in the same session it was introduced. The idea was to require anyone who sold hearing aids to have some basic knowledge about hearing loss, how to fit a hearing aid, and the rules established by the agency. The act allows a person to learn on the job and, or to take a course to learn the business. After taking and passing the approximately 3-hour exam, they can sell hearing aids without supervision. Prior to 1959, anyone who wanted to open a storefront could sell hearing aids or any hearing products. Audiologists receive extensive training at the graduate level in hearing aid technology, hearing aid selection, fitting, and follow-up. Hearing aids are part of the total rehab process, from diagnostic evaluation of hearing impairment to the essential instruction to follow-up care. In addition, continuing education is heavily weighted toward hearing aids and the complex issues surrounding the rehab process. For example, the question may arise as to whether the consumer is a candidate for a cochlear implant or an acoustic product. The audiologist has the expertise and training for this determination. Audiologists work in a variety of settings: hospitals, speech and hearing centers, school districts, educational service districts, regional programs for the deaf and hearing impaired, medical schools, schools for the deaf, HMOs, VA hospitals. All of these facilities hire audiologists to sell and deal in hearing aids. To my knowledge, none of them has employed hearing aid dealers to sell the product. Of note is the fact that the Veterans Administration has employed audiologists to fit hearing aids on a large number of veterans who have hearing losses. None of these audiologists have held a hearing aid dealer's license while fitting and dealing in hearing aids, because the agency has established that they are truly and fully qualified to provide service. Thank you for your time and consideration. I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Is this mic on? Yes, it is. Good morning. My name is Wendy Chapman, and I'm the current president of the Oregon Academy of Audiology. I've been an audiologist for 25 years, and in those 25 years, I've worked in a variety of settings, first as a trainee at the Portland Veterans Administration Hospital, then at the University of Oklahoma, setting up and running a satellite audiology clinic. I spent several years at the Portland Center for Hearing and Speech, which is a nonprofit agency. And then I worked for the Multnomah County ESD Audiology Services, serving children in the Multnomah County schools. And finally, I've been in private practice in a couple different medical clinics in the Portland area. In all of these positions, I have dealt with hearing aid issues, whether or not I was actually dispensing the product. clients would come in with complaints, perhaps about the fitting, not being satisfied with the amplification or the sound quality they were getting. They might come in with issues regarding the ear mold or the fit of the instrument. They might come in with maintenance problems, a hearing aid that's not working or weak or something like that. As an audiologist, I could deal with all of these problems that have to do with hearing aids without a hearing aid dealer's license, as long as I don't dispense the instrument. If an audiologist is qualified to deal with these hearing aid issues on the basis of education, training, and experience, then I don't see a reason why we couldn't also dispense them based on that same education, training, and experience. Audiologists are licensed by the state of Oregon, as you've heard Duane mention. And we have, our licensure law includes professional and ethical standards. And these standards are very lengthy, but there are just a few points that I think should be noted. Under OAR 335-005-0015, it states that audiologists shall honor their responsibility to hold paramount the welfare of persons they serve professionally, and that individuals shall fully inform the persons they serve of the nature and possible effects of services rendered and products dispensed. Also, it states that individuals shall evaluate the effectiveness of services rendered and of products dispensed, and shall provide services or dispense products only when benefit can be reasonably expected. Furthermore, 335-005-0020 is a section dealing with professional competence, and it states that individuals shall engage only in those aspects of the professions that are within their scope of competence, considering their level of education, training, and experience. And furthermore, that individuals shall continue their professional development throughout their careers. OAR 335-005-0025 deals with the accurate representation, and it states that individuals shall not misrepresent diagnostic information, services rendered or products dispensed, or engage in any scheme or artifice to defraud in connection with obtaining payment or reimbursement for such services or products. I want to thank you for your time in considering this issue before you today. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Any questions in this panel?
Representative
Westland.
Are you from Oklahoma originally?
No, I'm not. I'm from Oregon.
Well, I heard the reference to Norman, and I just wanted to make sure that she wasn't from the state that stole one of our great presidents. So.
No, not at all.
I will let that go.
But it's close by voting on the bill, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
John McCauley. You want Evan with you, or? Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCauley, representing the Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association. That's an association of speech language pathologists, audiologists, and teachers of the deaf and hard of hearing. We appear before you this morning to support House Bill 2684. And I'm not going to spend time duplicating the testimony that you've heard previously. I think the previous witnesses succinctly and appropriately stated the reasons that this bill is for you. I will just address a couple of issues relative to the measure. Obviously, we're dealing with both a regulatory issue and a consumer protection issue here. And we would argue that the regulatory issue of requiring dual licensure is not appropriate in light of the clinical professionalism and competence of the audiologists. And the fact that they have and can dispense hearing aids based on significant training. I state in my testimony that under the current Oregon law, a master's degree is required to be licensed as an audiologist. Soon, national clinical standards are being increased to require doctorate level to have a national certification for audiologists. Beginning in 2007, there will be a four-year transition period, at which time doctorate-level degree would be required to be clinically certified as an audiologist. I will leave with your committee what I copied from the American Speech Language Hearing website describing the requirements for an audiologist, and they are extensive, and would note in here that a significant portion of the training for an audiologist is devoted to hearing aids, and I think this really shows the competence that the audiologists have in dispensing hearing aids. As far as consumer protection goes, I've attached to my testimony, as did Ms. Ingram, the rules from the Speech Pathology and Audiology Board. And I think if you read those rules, you will note the heavy emphasis on consumer protection that exists there. The board does have two consumer members on it. It, I think, pays very close attention to making sure consumers are adequately protected. But as with Ms. Ingram, if this committee decides that additional consumer protections are needed to make you feel comfortable with this bill, we would support that as well. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Evan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. I am not here representing necessarily any organization except those of us that are in private practice, and as a private practice audiologist, we very much are in agreement with what you've already heard today. I have made available to you a little bit of my testimony that I was going to say, but we're saying the same things. And in light of duplication, thank you very much. If you have questions, I'd be more than happy to try to respond to them. But I do think that this is a bill that would be a very good bill for the public, for audiologists, for everyone involved. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You basically are licensed in two different areas, one as an audiologist and one as a hearing aid specialist or dealer.
Yes, thanks.
The audiology licensure basically governs your any malpractice items that might occur. Any consumer issues that would deal with the improperly treating the patient in terms of hearing. And it's only the licensing, it's only the dealer dispensing that you're concerned about?
I think, as I understand your question, the answer would be yes, that's true. The ethics, if you will, set forth by the Academy of Audiology or the Audiologist and Speech Hearing Association's Code of Ethics in terms of the American Speech and Hearing Foundation. Code of Ethics are more restrictive and I think are much better at confining our behaviors in terms of protection of the public.
Scope of practice.
And so this really is just a duplication of license, and it's confusing because audiology license requirements have certain requirements that we have to meet, and so does the hearing aid dealers or dispensers or specialists, but theirs are more concerned with, in my opinion, business practice and first aid and that sort of thing. We do that as a matter of course anyway under the audiology program. So we're faced with trying to satisfy two different requirements. And in my case, both myself and my wife are audiologists, and our dispenser's license comes at different times. So we have the audiology requirement, and we have the dispenser requirement for both of us, and they're at different time periods. So it gets very confusing. But yes.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Could you tell me also, maybe you or Mr. McCulley would know, how many physicians or otolaryngologists actually dispense hearing aids?
I can't give you a number. I would say that that is one thing I would ask you to just take a look at, because I had another audiologist bring it to my attention when I was coming here. And their position is that physicians oftentimes will hire a non-licensed person, or could hire a non-licensed person under their own medical license and circumvent the intent of this law. And so I would bring that to your attention only. That's not necessarily something that I want to make an issue. But yes, I don't know the answer to your question.
Okay. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Sir.
Scott Austin, John Brenneman.
Morning.
John's going to make me do all the talking.
You're better off that way.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair and distinguished committee members. I'm Scott Austin, the board-certified hearing aid specialist, past president of the International Hearing Society, Oregon Hearing Society, and current member of the Advisory Council on Hearing Aids, overseen by the Health Licensing Office. Today I'm representing the Oregon Hearing Society, a trade association for hearing aid specialists, to oppose House Bill 2684, a bill that would exempt audiologists and persons licensed to practice medicine from being required to hold a valid license as a hearing aid dealer. Currently in Oregon, any person desiring to sell FIT must hold a valid dealer license issued by the Health Licensing Office, a department in the Consumer and Business Services Division. Once again, the issue of exempting audiologists from the oversight of the Health Licensing Office has come before the legislature. The Health Licensing Office effectively oversees the consumer protection of several professional health occupations. This is where consumer affairs are best represented and consumer complaints are investigated and resolved. If passed, House Bill 2684 would remove consumer protection interests for Oregonians that purchase or receive hearing aids from audiologists or any licensed medical physician, regardless of their training or knowledge of hearing aid dispensing practices. Other Oregonians who choose to purchase hearing aids from licensed hearing aid dispensers would remain protected with rescission rights and certain assurances for their hearing aid purchase. Simply copying and pasting the consumer protection section of the hearing aid dealer law, ORS 694, into that of the licensing law for audiologists, ORS 681, would not solve this problem, as Oregon would now have two state agencies regulating identical consumer protection, adding confusion and differing enforcement potentials. It could also create an unlevel playing field for small business hearing aid dealers operating in a free enterprise marketplace from those dispensing from nonprofit hearing clinics. Removing 137 audiologists currently licensed under ORS 694 would cut the Health Licensing Office fees nearly 40%, which in turn would raise those fees to small business owners dispensing hearing aids. One question to ask proponents of this bill would simply be, why? What is broken that needs to be fixed, other than a small group of audiologists that have always wanted out from the guise of the Health Licensing Office? This proposed legislation is a flash from the past, being pushed by individuals living in the past fighting a turf battle that no longer exists. The main purpose for licensing those dispensing hearing aids is consumer protection, protection that their investment in hearing help be guaranteed, protection that the specialist they seek for help is qualified, licensed, and knowledgeable about up-to-date technology and products, protection that ensures them against dealing with unscrupulous, non-qualified, or ill-intended persons. The current hearing aid dispensing law and rules in Oregon work very effectively. There are no consumer, dispenser, or state agency problems needing to be fixed. House Bill 2684 would only serve to break down the effective system that we already have in place. I urge your committee to reject this bill, as it has no purpose other than to create more problems for the hearing impaired of Oregon. Thank you again for hearing my testimony, and I'd be available for any questions you may have.
Do you have anything to add, John?
Mr. Chair, John Brenneman, for the record, representing the Oregon Hearing Society. The only thing I'd add is for you to imagine a bit about the confusion for a consumer, someone who gets fit by hearing aids and has problems. I think you're going to find they'll have a hard time figuring out where to go if you have different oversight areas. It's much more efficient to have one oversight area where that person knows they can go and get their complaints taken care of.
If I might add, Mr. Chair, that we might want to consider an exemption for those that are dealing specifically in the education of clinical or research audiologists that don't dispense hearing aids not be required to have a hearing aid license, but then they're not dispensing, so why would they want one? But we'd be open to any kind of amendment like that.
Any questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wesley.
I particularly like the part of Mr. Austin's testimony where in the first line he acknowledges the committee is distinguished. I noticed he doesn't have any adjectives in front of your name.
But I'm not from Oklahoma.
And he's not from Oklahoma.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I guess I'm trying to take in all of this. So one of your concerns, as you mentioned on the second page, is that it would cut the fees nearly 40%. We do have a letter in possession from Susan White, who is the Director of Health Licensing Office, and she mentions that also, that it would be a $60,000 reduction. So you're saying that one of your concerns is that people who are now hearing aid dispensers would have to pick up those fees. Is
right.
that what I'm hearing?
Correct.
And why wouldn't that be fair if that were to happen?
Well, it's a minimal raise, to be quite honest with you. The fees are not extensive that it would put people out of business, but we've always felt, and it's always been addressed by the legislature, that if you dispense a hearing aid, you have a hearing aid license. Just as if you drive a motor vehicle, you have a driver's license, but if you choose to drive a motorcycle, you have to have a motorcycle endorsement. There are specific concerns. There are some audiologists who have their clinical competency certification prior to 1992 when there was no requirement for them to have hearing aid education in their master's degree programs. And most of those people are out today, but there are still those audiologists that don't have that experience with hearing aids or not up to date. I'd like to address one issue about the continuing education requirements for hearing aid specialists. We're required to have continuing education focus on hearing aid dispensing. It addresses hearing aid dispensing and all of that. There's a limit on how many hours can be given for credit on business management or marketing or those types of things. It has to be focused on hearing aid dispensing.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many hours are required?
Right now there are 9, and we are currently looking at increasing those.
Okay, thank you.
It's been that way for a long time.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Representative
Comer.
Yes, Susan? I think we may have some questions. Yeah.
Representative Comer. Will I hear everybody?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Thank you for your letter, Susan. So there are 137 hearing aid dealers who also are audiologists. So actually this bill refers to those 137. Am I correct in assuming that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, yes, you are correct in assuming that. I think you heard testimony that not all would choose to eliminate their license. We based it on the idea that everyone would have the opportunity to release their license, and that would be the number that is provided for you in that letter. I think earlier testimony.
Okay.
Yes.
In one moment. Susan, what's your name?
I apologize. Susan Wilson, Health Licensing Agency.
Okay. Now, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. As I said, I have a series. May I continue with those things? Okay. So, also, I heard an earlier testimony, and it just sort of went by quickly, and I want to come back to it, that hearing aid dealers, if a hearing aid is returned, a hearing aid dealer can keep 20% of the cost or the of the hearing aid. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, the way the law is currently set up is there is a rather extensive contract in place, and that's really what the Health Licensing Office is governing right now. There's a contract in place that allows the dispenser, the hearing aid dealer, to provide service to a hearing impaired person, and under the law, they have a certain percentage that they're entitled to if those hearing aids don't work out. It's very common that hearing aids take several times or fittings for them to work out. It protects the consumer knowing that they have a certain period of time they can return those hearing aids and get all their money back except for the 20% for the examination, the fitting, and that sort of
parameters within the law. We are changing that and moving that to rule because we want to make sure that we're keeping pace with the market. And so if hearing aids are going down in price or up in price, we want to make sure the consumer is getting what they need and the dispenser is getting what they need as it relates to providing the service of fitting, but the consumer gets all their money back if they return the hearing aids within that time period. That's really the contractual rights that the hearing aid dispenser law takes care of, is making sure that the consumer can go back and get their money back or get refitted and that they're satisfied.
Did I hear it correctly then that the audiologist who does not have a hearing aid license would not get that same 20%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, currently under the current law, they would get the 20% back because they are governed under the hearing aid dealer contract.
But if they were not, if they did not have the hearing aid license, then just if they were an audiologist but did not have the license.
There's not a provision in their law. That's correct.
So they would not get to keep that 20%.
Nor would the consumer get reimbursed if they returned the hearing aids.
Oh.
That's the public protection issue that's under discussion. The contract protects the consumer if they return the hearing aids. It's a guarantee. The consumer has a certain length of time to test the hearing aids to make sure they fit their hearing loss.
But what I want to understand is that the audiologist who does not have the hearing aid license,
mm-hmm.
the consumer who gets their hearing aid from them,
mm-hmm.
would not have that same protection. Is
that's
that
correct.
Correct. Okay. Oh. Okay, thank you. And you mentioned licensure tracking will be required until a history can be established. What does that mean? That's on your 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph down. You don't have it?
Sorry. She's getting it for me.
Okay.
Okay, your question again. I'm sorry.
In the 4th paragraph down, 2nd sentence, licensure tracking will be required until a history can be established.
I understand your question, Representative Tomei. We don't know right now. We've heard varying testimony. I think earlier testimony said that most hearing aid dealers are 98 individuals or 98%. Audiologists said they would keep their license as a hearing aid dealer. So the 60%, what I'm trying to say here is that's the outside figure. If 137 audiologists chose tomorrow not to get their license if this law went through, that would be the effect on our revenue. But we have no licensing statistics to determine whether or not the represented comments today that 98% would keep their license. So I'm giving you kind of a ballpark figure of where it would be if the law is implemented today. 137 audiologists could opt out.
And you would have to track them.
Right, in order to tell you exactly how much revenue and how much their fees would increase. That's what that sentence or paragraph.
Okay, and what are the fees used for?
The fees are used for operating the consumer protection program within the health licensing office. They pay a shared service to operate under an umbrella agency that is Consumer Protection Agency. They pay specific direct costs for any program related. For example, if we were prosecuting any consumer complaint under the Hearing Aid Dealers Program, they would pay for the Attorney General, the hearings officer, and any investigation.
Got it. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wilson, do you have a sense of how often individual hearing aid dealers actually return all the money to clients as a matter of best practice or normal business procedures? Or maybe that question would be more appropriate for the hearing aid dealer folks. But
Mr. Chair and Representative Dalto, I can get that information. I don't have it with me today. I know that the consumer rescission rights are very important component for consumer protection in the state of Oregon. But I don't have those specific figures, but I would be happy to get those for you. They may have some numbers. Scott Austin may be able to give you.
Mr. Chair, would it be permissible that we'd invite Mr. Austin up to answer that question?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dolfo. The question about the percentage, I can only give you a ballpark figure, a guesstimate of my own, but I've been around it for quite a while. I would venture to say that close to 80% of people who purchase hearing aids get their money back if they turn them back. A very small percentage of people do it because it is best common practices. People may not like the hearing aid for one reason or another, and they give it back. Only in the cases I find that people withhold the 20% or a part of that, some people don't withhold all of it, they agree to a fee, would be in the case when the patient doesn't try, evaluate the hearing aid, work with the dispenser, and they just more or less, maybe they change their mind overnight or whatever. That dispenser will hold that for his cost and time of doing the testing and the fitting and the follow-up that's required in that hearing aid dispense.
Mr. Chair. And so how often, Mr. Austin, do you hear of complaints or disputes about a refund?
Up until about 2.5-3 years ago, the advisory council had very little complaints. As a matter of fact, hearing aid complaints for a medical device was the lowest of all medical devices, 0.1% of the hearing aid dispense in the state. I think it was 1995 we dispensed 28,000 hearing aids in the state, and there were less than 28 complaints with the licensing division. Some of those complaints were people not getting their licensing on time, late fees, and those kinds of things, so they weren't all consumer-related issues as well. And then a couple of years ago, we had one hearing aid person who created numerous complaints, and so that skewed the complaints to dispensing quite a bit, but it was over one individual who has been revoked and is no longer in the business and is still under some heavy fines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. If 80% of the hearing aid specialists give all the money back, why would we think the audiologists would be different?
Well, I would hope that they wouldn't be. I mean, if we have a person that's not satisfied, they've worked with the dispenser or the audiologist to get to a successful hearing aid fitting, and it doesn't work, then it's my personal opinion that that person shouldn't have to pay for that. But I think, here again, that's best business practices. But the law does not, I mean, we have to go by what the law says, and there has to be some protection in there for both. Audiologists are protected under this law as well, because without this protection, had a hearing aid person tried their hearing aid, they could come back to an audiologist without this protection a year later and want their money back on that product.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Committee, the chair has signed on to this bill because I have some concerns about the fairness of dual licensure, but at the same time I have some concerns about moving things outside of the purview of the health licensing office, which I helped create in 1999, and so, you know, I kind of like things that I create, and so I still have some concerns. I think maybe there's a few more issues need to be addressed on this, so it's not my intent to move it at this point in time until we can make sure that consumer protection is taken care of. The dual licensure is an issue. The impact on Susan Wilson's department could be handled. I'm more concerned about making sure that moving things outside of the scope of the management we have is, if done for appropriate reasons. So I'm going to close the public hearing on 2684. We will not go into work session today. Let's see. We don't have Grover's not here. He's next door still.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Committee will stand at ease for a moment. I think he's next door. And Betsy's. It's going to take a while.
How's your showing, or your husband showing, going?
Great.
I would have been there, but I was where you normally.
committee will reconvene. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2519. Sandy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2519 is a bill that establishes and declares adult foster home provider rights. It directs each adult foster home provider to post a copy of the provider rights.
Okay. Grover.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Grover Simmons, for the record. I represent the Adult Care Providers of Oregon, the trade association that represents adult foster homes throughout the state. There are two other witnesses here this morning, Mr. Chair. Could we call them up?
Yes.
Joan England and Joan Gallagly. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for scheduling this bill. It's a subject that's been around and with us for quite a number of years. We drafted this language many years ago, maybe six or eight, and a couple of times I pled the case for the industry. Unsuccessfully, with vigor, but unsuccessfully. And then last session, and again this session, you introduced the bill on your own motion, and we appreciate that so very much. It gets the subject back before the legislature. After you had the bill put into bill form this year, I got a call from the seniors and people with disabilities department indicating that they were analyzing the bill, and I said, well, why don't I come by for a discussion of it, which I did. And I met at that time with Mrs. Mickey Tate and Mrs. Anna Mallard. We had a productive discussion. We went through the bill line by line, and in order to bring peace into the House, I volunteered to withdraw at least four sections from the printed bill to see if that would get us together and we could jointly sign on to the bill. And I'll go through those in just a moment. But then a couple of weeks later, I hadn't heard back from the division, so I again contacted them and went by and met again, and I said, well, have you had time to reassess the bill after our discussion, and are we together on it? Can you sign on to this? And how about it? What's the status? Well, no, we can't do that. And I said, well, that's very interesting. They said most of the things that are in this bill are already in administrative rule. They would be willing to compile all that information and make it available to case managers, for example, and to providers. Secondly, they indicated they were willing to draft an executive letter and send that out to case managers and providers and other people affected by this bill. It's kind of, I guess that was a peace offering, but they didn't want the legislature involved. That went down pretty solid with me. I just couldn't understand that. But they don't want the legislature to pass judgment on this subject. The four items that I had agreed to take out are item in the printed bill of 2519, item 3, to decline to perform services for the resident or family of the resident that are beyond the scope of services specified by a department rule or by a contract between the resident and the provider. That seemed logical. If it's beyond the ability of the provider to do the work, they ought to be able to decline the work. Number 5, we offered to take out, to decline to contract with a referred resident if admission of that resident to the adult foster home would compromise resident care needs or create a fire or life safety issues, or if access is denied to the information described in Section 4. That was the second thing that we offered to take out. We offered to take out Section 10 on the back side of the bill, to receive a written report describing all observations, conclusions, and recommendations not later than the 60th day after a visit, an investigation of alleged rule violation, an administrative conference or hearing. Then we decided to take out item 14, to be accorded due process of law. Well, we all enjoy due process of law, whether it's in writing or not, and so it didn't hurt us to take that out of there, but I thought it was a little bit much of the division to ask that it be deleted because they said it's redundant. I don't believe it ever hurts to reiterate United States constitutional protections one way or another, whenever and wherever we need to, and I would say almost particularly on this very day. The other item, the last item that I did agree to change, or not agree, I offered to change these things simply because I was trying to get us all together. I offered to it. It's item number 4. It says, to have access to all pertinent information about the health or emotional status of a resident or potential resident, and here's what we excluding AIDS and HIV information that is necessary to protect the health, safety, and welfare of other adult foster home residents or the operation of the home. Now, we all know that that type of information on AIDS and HIV is protected as confidential information. There are lots and lots of rules and procedures on that subject, and I just said, let's get that off the table. And so we would add the words excluding AIDS and HIV information. So it would take another possible point of disagreement off the table. And that was the purpose of doing that. So those changes were then incorporated in a new amendment, which I meant to give you right now.
We knew that, Grohl.
In any event, Mr. Chair, whatever your pleasure is, you may stay with the full draft, the printed bill, or go with the amendments. In either case, the purpose of the amendments was simply to keep peace in the House and get some agreement on a provider rights bill, which is, I'm sorry to say, sorely needed. In the old times, there was a tremendous, almost adversarial relationship between the adult foster home movement and the enforcers, the people who oversaw the program from a government's point of view. Over time, there's been less and less of that. As the people pointed out to me, they have trained and educated their caseworkers and case managers better. The providers are more sophisticated than they were years ago. So we are seeing fewer adversarial situations arise, and I think that's beneficial. We still need this bill, as the next witness will point out. Mrs. Joan England has a case history, current case history, and I think I made a checklist the other day as she told me the story by telephone. I think there are about 6 or 7 violations of these proposed rules in her story. So please go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Joan England. I'm nervous. I run a foster care home on Highway 22 just west of Salem, and I've done it for 10 years. Last February, I took a resident into my home. She was brought up from Albany. She had a son that lived in Salem, a daughter that lived in Klamath Falls. The son would visit occasionally, and upon visits would upset his mother physically due to the communications that they would have. Normally, it was over money, so which isn't uncommon. On Mother's Day last year, there was a verbal outbreak in the home, where he was asked to please either settle down or to leave the home because he was really upsetting her. She was on oxygen and she was having a hard time breathing. so it escalated from Mother's Day until August, and he approached the home in August, 1st of August, came into my home and started to talk to his mother about a situation in the family. She was scheduled for surgery that Thursday herself. In the past month, she had lost two of her siblings, and one other one was passing away at the time, and we didn't want to tell her this because of her upcoming surgery. So he was approaching her to tell her this, and I stepped in. I intervened during this to advocate for her well-being, and he assaulted me. So I called my state licensing agent even before I called the police and asked if I ever had to let this man back into my home again. And they said, no, I didn't have to do that. So rather than have him arrested, I had a no trespass order issued. Please don't issue restraining orders against someone who's not a family member. And this gentleman was not related to me. So they ordered a no trespass order, which meant he couldn't come back on the property. So I called the police. The police removed him and issued him that order. Well, he filed a complaint against me with the state. Okay, and the state came out and investigated this complaint. Protective Services came out. When they came out, they did not identify themselves as to who they were. They did not tell me why they were there. They took my lady the day after her surgery into her room alone, where she had asked, please, not to be harassed or you know, bothered that particular day. She wasn't well. He continued to interview her. He continued still to that day. I had no idea why he was out to my home. I still had no idea what the complaint was. The violation was this. It was, I was cited for not allowing her son back into my home to visit her. So I had a complaint issued and also cited against me. So it was a substantiated complaint is what the state says. So I went to move this lady out because the state wanted me to continue to have this man come into my home and visit his mother. And the state, they had an informal hearing at my home and told me that I could not move her out. So not only did I have to keep her, I had to keep allowing her son to come into my home, which was a threat to myself and also the other residents in my home. So in the interim, they suggested that maybe he be accompanied by an ombudsman, which is an advocate for the seniors, just to supervise the visitations to see how things went. For 4 weeks, he was supervised, and after 4 weeks, they said since he behaved himself those 4 weeks that it was okay that he come back in alone. And I disagreed with this. I tried to make an attempt to not allow him back in, not only for my, like I said, my well-being, but the resident, my other residents that were upset about this man coming into the home. So my resident agreed to visit with her son outside of the home, which was fine, and I had offered that myself. So he would come on Sunday, and they would go outside and visit, which was absolutely fine. But every week he came, he called the state and complained about me, and every week they came out and investigated me. So finally I contacted the state and I said, the stress in the home was so high that I finally said, how is it that I can move this woman out of my home? You guys won't let me move her because of the visitation situation. They told me that they did not regulate my private pay contracts and that if I chose to move her, if she were in a nursing home was what they told me, the nursing home would probably increase her rate because of the behavioral problems in the situation that was part of the whole problem. So I increased her rate, and the family moved her out. So,
Mr. Chair, again, Grover Simmons. With respect to increasing that rate, was that your idea, or did somebody suggest that that was a possibility?
The state. I went to the state, and that they told me they wouldn't allow me to move her on a 30-day because of the violence that was in the home, because the woman wanted to stay. She didn't want to move.
Mr. Chairman, the point I'm trying to get on the record is that the state can't determine the amount of the contract, but they can make a recommendation, mm-hmm. and that's apparently what happened here. Mm-hmm. I just made a checklist of the violations that potential violations that would have occurred if this bill had been in place. One is to be treated with respect and consideration by licensors, inspectors, and others. I think that Dr. Story indicates that she was not treated with respect and a recognition of a professional nature of the service. To be shown identification by licensors and Ombudsman Debbie, well, she indicated they were not. She was not shown an identification of the person by the person who came out. To be informed in writing at the initial contact or visit by a person described in subsection of the details of the complaint or allegation. To receive an accurate report of any evaluation conducted by a regulatory agency, to be informed of any observed deficiencies, so forth. So I guess the point is that there is a need for the bill. It's a continuing problem throughout the industry. I would agree that, and I hope, that it's not as widespread as it used to be, but it's still with us, and we just need some relief. Thank you very much.
Joan? My name is Sharon Cruz and committee members. My name is Joan Gallagly. I'm the president of the Adult Care Providers of Oregon, and I have testimony to give in support of House Bill 2519. I would like to read into the record testimony on the behalf of the providers throughout the state. The following are issues one provider had over a 15-year period in her foster home. The provider was contacted by a family member requesting that a client be placed in her foster home. The provider contacted the client's caseworker. She told the caseworker of this request and that she would like to accept the client. The provider explained that she had experience with depressed clients, which category this client came in. The worker stated that she would not let her go into her foster home, although the action was requested by a family member. Second, a complaint was issued against the provider, which was proved false after she provided her own investigation. The complaint cost the provider $10,000 to have the complaint fully investigated. The state investigation was grossly mishandled without the true facts of the issue being considered. Providers' rights were denied in that the state did not do a full investigation and did not look at all the facts. Number three, provider received a call in the AM informing her that senior and disabled services agencies were going to move her client without explanation of why. The provider was told, "I can't tell you." 3 months later, a complaint was issued against her. Licensor was called after normal business hours, after 5 p.m., regarding a 30-hour training class. This class is the basic training class for all providers before running a foster home. The same licensor also made accusations regarding withholding the client's medication treatment. This particular resident was declining to take the medication. The doctor was notified but had not responded at the time of this conversation. The provider held the medication until doctor responded with a discontinue order. It is against the residents' rights to enforce them to take medication that they don't want to take. This particular medication that the client was refusing to take was provided by the daughter, as the daughter was responsible for filling prescriptions. The daughter did not provide a full prescription of this medication. She only delivered 2 pills of this particular prescription. When provider tried to explain this prescription amount that was delivered to her, the licensor basically said the provider was lying. One of the state licensors came into the provider's home displaying disrespectful and rude actions. This affected all the clients in the home. The effects of this action on the residents had to be dealt with by the provider after the person left. On another visit to the provider's home by the same individual, was at a time of a grieving family and visitors were in the home. A client had just passed away. Again, the action of this individual upset everyone there to the point he was asked to leave and his actions reported to his supervisor. This licensor made a complaint against the provider. The provider requested a hearing and was found not guilty of any wrongdoing. This individual's actions were investigated by his superiors and as well as the result, the person was demoted from licensor to caseworker. Here again, a disrespectful agent continues to work inappropriately with long-term care industry. The providers of the foster home still have to deal with this individual. Number six, provider was given a warning about a rule. She complied with the warning, yet 3 months later, she was served with a penalty and a fine. All actions on the assumption of the licensor. The warning was given, corrective action taken immediately, yet provider was still found at fault, even though correction action was taken within the time frame for such a situation. Still, punitive actions were given. Information from another, and this was, I'm not going to read that one because that was Joan England's. A statement from another provider. A provider took a resident into her home who came from another state. Caseworker did not know her behavior history. The resident was disruptive to other residents and staff. The resident was given a 30-day notice. Rule states the resident is entitled to a hearing if she disagrees with the notice. The resident did not want to move. She requested a hearing. At the hearing, she said many things that indicate she might not want to stay in the home. Even the licensor asked her, why would she want to stay in the home? Without talking to other residents or the caregiver, it was determined that the provider did not have good reason for asking her to leave. It was the final decision of the hearings board that the resident be allowed to stay. Resident was causing another resident to have frequent asthma attacks, which were life-threatening to the resident. Provider had no recourse. The other resident threatened to move if disrupting resident did not. As the provider had a low census, she was forced to close her home. This is truly a case of no rights for the provider. This is another situation that has not been investigated thoroughly and arbitrary decisions made on part of the hearing board without full facts. And this morning, you don't have this on yours because I just got it this morning. It was faxed over to me from another provider. Provider took a resident into her home in good faith. After a fashion, it was discovered the resident had a collection of knives. The family was asked to remove the collection of knives as the resident had a diagnosis of mental illness. When approached with the idea of taking the knives, the resident became out of control. He threatened the caregiver and the residents. Provider asked protective services to assist in removing the resident. She was given a violation and told she could not ask the knives to be taken. I would urge you to vote to pass House Bill 2519. We need rights. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, Representative
Bonner. How did the person cause asthma?
She would cause her to get excited. And then she, when in the exciting, she would go into an asthma attack, which is stress causes asthma.
Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you get this bill, how much would this supersede over the department's control? Would this just take it out of their hands and allow you to post on the wall your rights?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, it would do a couple of things. It would require the adult foster home provider to post the law, as you indicate. And by the way, you know already that the residence rights, Bill of Rights, needs to be posted, and that's been our history for years. So this new posting would occur. But the operative point is that it would allow, in cases like these that we've heard, it would allow the provider to, as it says in number 12, to file a complaint with the offending agency. So you just simply make a protest to the Seniors and People with Disability Department, spelling out the details of these transgressions, and hopefully the state governing agency would intercede and say, well, we do have a problem worker down here. We're going to do something about it. It does not generate a cause of action, a legal cause of action, which would give the provider a right to sue in a civil court, but it's the next best step insofar as resolving personnel problems. It gives us a right to file a complaint with the government agency, and if there's a lot of goodwill, something would be done about it.
I've read the four sections that you've taken out. They all seem to be fairly reasonable. Were they taken out because you felt that you couldn't get it, you know, the whole bill by in terms of the department without those being taken out?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, frankly, I was just trying to make a concession as an expression of goodwill and cooperation. We've been with this subject for all these years, and I've not been able to get it through. So I thought, well, if I make it a little easier to live with, maybe the division will agree and we can jointly go to the committee and say this is a jointly sponsored bill. But it didn't happen.
Seems to me that it, to ask the provider to do something that's beyond the scope of their services is
pretty reasonable.
That's not in the benefit of the department either.
Yeah, that's.
And if you go down through some of these, they're really reasonable requests.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Helen and Cindy. Good morning.
Hi.
Please go ahead.
Cruz. I am the committee members. My name is Helen Leary. With a name like that, I think I'm obligated to wish you a happy St. Patrick's Day. However, from the spelling, you'll note that I'm not Irish, but I felt obligated to wear green nonetheless. I'm from Oregon City, and I am the chair of the Legislative Committee of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. We're the commission that consists of advocates from across the state who advises on programs and services for the elderly. And I am here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2519. First of all, I would like to state very clearly we strongly support our adult foster home providers. And we sincerely value the role they play in the long-term care system in Oregon, which has been a model system. However, we think this legislation is bad public policy for three reasons. One, because it may intimidate residents and their loved ones. Two, because it could hamper investigations of abuse and regular licensing activities. And last, we really feel it's unnecessary. I'd like to expand on those three reasons. The most important reason is really that it may intimidate residents and their families. All of the residents in any long-term care facility are dependent upon the staff to perform critical daily tasks. In an adult foster care home, that's the owner and resident managers. And even in the current environment, many will not raise concerns and they will not complain. They're afraid that their care provider could retaliate or even evict them from what has become their home. If we post provider rights in the same manner that we post residents' rights, we are tipping the balance of power even further in the direction of the provider and away from the client. To specifically mention termination of a resident's contract and the right to deny services as the proposed provider rights do, will definitely intimidate many residents. The second reason, abuse allegations must be kept confidential if residents and their family and friends are to feel able to report suspected abuse. Sometimes the facts are not clear, and by forcing licensors and abuse investigators to put the reason and details in writing could hamper those very important investigations. It is also wrong to ban staff from access to private living quarters of the provider. A provider could just hide critical evidence in those quarters when the investigators show up. We do agree that all providers should be treated with respect and consideration by the Department of Human Services and visiting staff. We believe that's already true, and in any case cannot be legislated. All long-term care facilities, including adult foster homes, have rights under current law and have access to due process. They can already refuse to take a specific resident for any reason. Providers can testify before a legislative committee and provide information to any state agency without being intimidated. They can have an attorney or other person come with them when they are meeting with any government agency. Therefore, the legislation is not needed. We ask that you do not pass this legislation, and I thank you for allowing me to testify to you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's both testify, then we can ask questions. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Hannum, and I oversee the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care. This is the long-term care regulatory agency for foster homes, nursing facilities, and so forth, within seniors and people with disabilities. I'm actually just going to echo Helen's comments here, and I'd like to add a few things. We are in opposition of this bill, but in no way are we in opposition of the rights of foster care providers. We value them very much. The problem with this bill is twofold. One, by requiring posting is really for the residents and their families. That's who reads those, the general public that comes in. And there is a very clear tone here that would really say to a resident or family, I have rights. I'm going to know about any allegations that you give against me. It will very much squelch the ability of family and residents to try to solve problems. I know that is not what is intended by the providers, but that is the practical effect of this bill. If I could just comment on a couple other points, and I'll actually refer to Grover's amendment since he is willing to concede on some of the others. Item three, which is to have access to health care information. Certainly, providers need to have the relevant information related to the care that they are expected to give. We don't question that. But there's a lot of confidential information that may be between patient-physician that is not relevant to the care. Psychiatric is a primary example. So actually, this is sweeping, even though he has factored in the HIV type of information. Going on to number five, this is to be informed in writing of the initial visit. Now, there's a couple problems here. We train our staff so that they, whenever possible, inform the provider of why they are there, be it a licensing visit, be it an actual investigation complaint. There are times, however, when the person making the complaint has asked for that to remain anonymous. There are times when there are residents who are afraid. They are afraid. And in a small foster home, there are only five maximum residents there and the provider. It would be very problematic when you have residents who feel they are at risk to think that the minute we walk in the door, we are going to announce why we are there. Providers will figure out immediately by the nature of the allegation, and this requires details. This requires, my reading is, everything that we know in terms of the complaint has to be given. And there are other parts of the law that allow complainants to make anonymous complaints. Again, I know the reason foster home providers have asked for this. They just want to know what is going on, which in general is a very fair issue. But this directly conflicts with the right of complainants to try to keep the information confidential. I do agree that once we are able to disclose that information, that we absolutely should do so. I do agree that providers have an absolute right to an evidence-based, clear report so that, you know, they can see what actions we may be taking and what the findings are. But it's very problematic to demand in writing at the time that we first knock on the door for as much details as we have. So we would strongly object to that. I see Grover has taken out the 60 days, which is good because the department with all of the staffing reductions is really having to triage protective service, and that would have been problematic. In terms of the living quarters, it makes sense that if providers have their own private part of the apartment, why would the department be going in there? We would not normally, and we train our staff, but there are times when there are allegations or there are other issues that have arisen where we believe there might be residents residing. We have had that happen. We have had residents, a sixth resident, staying in the provider's living quarters, and we didn't know about it, and state law requires five or fewer. So there are issues here that while this appears on the surface to be very fair and reasonable, we've got to leave it to the discretion of what the issues are for the licensors and the folks who are going out to be able to make a judgment here. Because the provider's quarters are part of the very structure that is licensed to, in fact, provide care. The last thing, again, that I really want to emphasize is the posting. The posting would be very intimidating, not only in terms of the issues that I have raised to you, but it's right up there for everyone to see that I, the provider, am to be treated with respect. And while that makes perfect sense, and we would all agree to that, when you have residents who are in a vulnerable position, who are highly dependent on the provider, who have a relationship where their very health care and well-being depends on them, that's an intimidating type of statement to make. Otherwise, certainly we have tried very hard to work with the adult foster home providers. I have changed the training for the licensors statewide, so we have increased the training, and we even have a mentoring program for new licensors, because I agree and I am concerned that there be statewide application of all of the licensing regulations in a fair and equitable manner, and I want the staff to be trained. And we also afford to Grover open forum anytime. The staff he mentioned to you that he had talked to are, in fact, a manager and a program coordinator under me, and we are available to talk to Grover and any provider at any time about issues. So we've done our very best within seniors and people with disabilities to honor and respect this important care provider organization. And I also would be happy to answer any questions.
Before we get to questions, just a couple comments. It would seem to me that if a provider had a resident living in their private living quarters, by definition, that would no longer be private living quarters. And the other one on Grover's amendments, number three, as far as access to pertinent information, that would fall under HIPAA regulations, which I think would be fairly protective by their very nature. So, Representative Tomei, you had questions?
Well, actually, the question was about why it would be important to go into their private quarters, and it's been explained. But my stepmother was in a foster home until she passed away. And this, of course, is the living of the people who are running the foster home. And I guess I would think it would be extremely important to have pertinent information, certainly about psychiatric issues. And you think that should be excluded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, what they should have are things that are relevant to their ability to do care. So certainly in terms of any sort of illnesses or any sort of behavior that they need to adopt into their care plan, I absolutely agree with you. There are certain issues, though, that the treating physician may not wish to have the care provider know. And that's part of any patient physician relationship.
Can you give us an example, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
An example of that?
Well, there could be something. I don't have an exact specific case example for you, Representative Tomei, but if a physician were treating someone based upon a diagnosed mental illness and there were history there were issues that the physician felt were either past history or felt that was contained within the patient resident or the patient physician, and the patient was trying not to have the provider be aware of that. If it did not affect that patient's ability to live in the home, if it didn't endanger other people, and it was just plain patient-physician treatment information, I think that's common, that care providers do not necessarily get that information.
Follow-up?
Yes.
So could that be amended to say to exclude items determined by a physician to be inappropriate to be shared?
Yes, Representative Tomei.
Thank you.
I guess I'm not sure. Maybe my understanding is not complete here, but I'm not sure that having this in statute would necessarily compel a physician to disclose information that he didn't want to. So, like I said, this would fall under HIPAA, so which has created a whole new universe as far as information, and one that's going to evolve over the next few years. So, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We talk about not being able to evict somebody. When can you evict somebody? I mean, well, how much do they have to put up with? If a person is in care and is somewhat delusionary and saying that, they're having sex, the caregiver and somebody else's. So can they say that enough of that? You know, that isn't true. You're out of here.
Actually, there are many conditions, Representative Barker, where there are regulations within our licensing rules where they can do an involuntary move out. One of them is if the care just gets too difficult for them, because every care provider has a different ability to do care. Another is if there is a behavior that is very problematic for the home. Failure to pay is another reason. There are a variety of reasons, and these are fairly common among all of the licensed care providers. The process that actually happens is that there is a required notice period, and if the resident objects, then they can appeal. And we do informal oversight of that within seniors and people with disabilities, but it also can go to a full contested case hearing. So there's always the possibility that, based upon the information, the evidence, that the hearing officer will in fact decide one way or the other. And I have seen situations where there are residents who were allowed to stay based upon a hearing order and where the provider was able to discharge based upon a hearing order. So it really depends upon all of the facts and the evidence with the situation. But they absolutely can discharge. Yes.
Follow up?
Yes.
And just looking at the proposed bill, I don't see where it says that would change. Am I missing something?
I think, let's see, I'm trying to find that.
Number two.
Thank you.
List some more.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, our objection to number two was not based upon the transfer rules because we are in support of both residents and the providers exercising their rates there. Our concern was the reference back to number three and whether providers would be discharging based upon health information that was not necessary for the care and services.
And our concern with that particular one is to post the words to terminate, that then the resident seeing that, and we're talking about a person, please remember these are elderly people who are vulnerable, fragile, this has become their new home, they're dependent entirely on their care here. If they see those words, they don't know what these rules are. Those rules exist already. And so to post to terminate, that's what we're concerned about.
One more here. In three, it says have access to all pertinent information, so it doesn't say all information. So, I mean, I understand some of your concerns, but also, from hearing the testimony, I'm concerned about the providers. I mean, and that's becoming a more, as I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, more and more important. And I know in the Portland area, a lot of the Romanian people are taking that, a big time of foster care. And seem to be doing a good job from the few cases I've seen. But okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a lot of questions. I think I heard testimony saying that the rules generally are not read very much by the people inside. And if they are, let me go back. Having practiced 35 years in dentistry and having to post a number of regulations on our wall, I can tell you that probably less than 1% of the people that came in my doors read those regulations, staff or outsiders. I would assume that these are posted mostly for the family who can read them, who are ambulatory, who can stand up high enough to read the regulation on the wall, and that those are the people we really want to be posting for. You have caseworkers, I would assume, that can explain those rules either for the client, the patient, or for the provider, can explain those to the client. Can you not?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, here is the problem. Here is the problem. We are talking about regulating where there are many, many private pay people. Not all of these clients have a case manager. Many don't. There are many homes who do not have Medicaid contracts. So we have homes then that are out in everybody's neighborhood, rural, urban, who are not seen on a regular basis other than by those families. And if there's a visiting ombudsman and a licensor who comes once a year or responds to complaints. So what you have, and we have seen this through many, many years of experience, we have folks who move in, they become very dependent on that provider. That's a 24-hour living situation that becomes their home. If it's going well, it's fabulous. If it's not going well, you have vulnerable people there who have no means of recourse other than if they feel that they can safely, if they can't solve the problem with the provider, and usually they do, but sometimes they don't. And sometimes there are bad situations, bad. So what do? They have to feel that there's a way that they can gain access outside the support. And the provider has an upper hand there just by the nature of the relationship. They are the one who is caring. They are the one who is feeding. They are the one who is doing all of the support that individual needs. Our concern is not for the good homes where, you know, people problem solve, people treat each other well, and there are many, many wonderful homes. As a regulator, I have to worry about the problematic homes. And there always are some, as there are in any kind of licensure activity. And what we worry about is people who, by posting language that really is not addressed to the family and residents. Most of this was because the care providers were concerned about licensors activity and ombudsman activity. And they were concerned that they were not being treated fairly by the regulatory agency, which we have worked hard on the years to try to correct. But for families and so forth to see this, they don't see that in some of this. They just see that, oh my God, if I complain, they're instantly going to know about it. The first thing that has to happen is the person coming in has to tell the provider who I'm afraid of today. And again, this is a few homes. Most of the homes are very good. Now, what would that do? That would make someone not want to tell. So how do we make sure that while providers are both treated fairly, that we make sure the vulnerable people who are living there have an opportunity to say what they need to say, to get help if they need to get help? That's the concern.
Yes. Well, that's already posted. The client's rights are posted in the law already. I guess I miss where the provider doesn't have the right to have some rights posted as well.
Representative Anderson, the issue is people are so afraid to come forward about abuse now. That is a phenomena that experts in elder abuse, that a good many people in the audience can tell you. People put up with a lot because they're afraid to tell somebody. The fact that there's a piece of paper on the wall that tells you you can tell somebody is good, but it certainly doesn't overcome the relationship that you have with someone who is in a power position over you by being your caregiver.
And I guess that really leads to where I really want to have some information. That is, you mentioned the ombudsman, you mentioned the licensor. Can they not be accessed by a patient or a patient's family if they feel that something's wrong? Or do you just wait until like 1 year before you evaluate any problem?
No, actually, Representative Anderson, they can call at any time. We have abuse hotlines. They can call the local office. They can call the state office. The point is making sure people feel comfortable to do so.
Right.
And many people choose to be anonymous. Many people ask us, please do not tell them I've said this. I don't want them to know because I'm afraid. People say that.
That's fine. I guess I'm biased because I have a very good experience with two wonderful homes. And I'd have to say that I can understand problems at times. My mother had Alzheimer's. There was times during her treatment where she was really irrational. She was claiming almost psychotic things against other patients that we knew weren't true.
Mm-hmm.
And the home was very careful. But my point in this is, the family needs to be, if there's family, or the ombudsman, or the licensor needs to be looking at it and saying, time to move this patient out. There's just not good chemistry here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move her over to, or he over to a different home. And I think this is very reasonable in saying there are rights where the home has the chance to say, you know, this isn't working out well. We need to depend on the state to come in and make that move, not to fight it. And that's what I heard from the testimony before.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim and May. Jim's gone. I bet he's just right outside. Yeah, I knew he was.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is May Dash. I'm a volunteer for the Alzheimer's Association. Our Oregon Public Policy Committee advocates for the nearly 70,000 Oregonians afflicted with Alzheimer's disease and related disorders and for their families. We strongly oppose House Bill 2519, the creation of an adult foster care provider bill of rights, rights that already are covered by Oregon and federal law. We are especially troubled by subsections 2, 3, 4, 5, and 13 under Section 2. Each of these subsections directly challenges, even threatens, facility residents and their families. More than 60% of the residents in adult foster care homes suffer from dementia, primarily Alzheimer's disease. This population constitutes some of the most vulnerable individuals in our society. The adult foster care industry apparently views this proposed Bill of Rights as a counterpart to residents' rights, hardly a legitimate comparison, since the purpose of residents' rights is to empower the extremely fragile long-term care population. Providers have rights, as do everyone else within the long-term care system, but they do not have the vulnerability that justifies the approach taken in the Residents' Bill of Rights. Many residents in long-term care settings, as well as their concerned families, feel as though they are held hostage. Family members attending our Alzheimer's support group meetings often state that they are afraid to voice complaints to facility personnel, even when their complaints are justified, for fear of retaliation or eviction. That is an especially ominous prospect if the person is a Medicaid client or a difficult Alzheimer's patient. Oregon's adult foster care home system was developed to provide a home-like, friendly environment for frail and elderly persons in need of some assistance. A provider bill of rights posted in each facility, perhaps given to each client at the time of admission, is the antithesis of this concept. It really has no place in a home-like setting. It should not become a part of Oregon law. The Alzheimer's Association urges you to vote against House Bill 2519, and we thank you for considering our concerns. Thank you.
Jim.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Alzheimer's Association of Oregon and Greater Idaho, United Seniors of Oregon, Gray Panthers, and the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. We strongly oppose House Bill 2519, which creates the Adult Foster Home Provider Bill of Rights. We feel this legislation is unnecessary and could potentially have detrimental effects on the rights of residents and their families. Adult foster home providers already have adequate protection under the law and certainly don't need a Bill of Rights to strengthen their ability to do such things as terminate resident contracts, decline to perform services, access information on residents' health and emotional status, decline to accept an applicant, access grievance and complaints processes, and access and affect access for ombudsmen and investigators. As stated by May Dash, to actually post such a Bill of Rights would further intimidate residents and their families who are already hesitant to make waves to avoid repercussions that to their often frail and vulnerable loved ones and residents. Although adult foster home providers deserve adequate protections and great respect for the work that they do, if anybody's rights should be strengthened, it should be the rights of the adult foster home residents and not the providers. We urge your opposition to House Bill 2519.
Questions? I'm not going to look at that slide anymore. Thank you very much. David Meredith. Even when Westland's back, I'm not going to look at that. Good morning.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm David Niebel. I work for the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Citizens Coalition for Quality Long-Term Care, which is a grassroots group that, as you might suspect, advocates for residents in long-term care facilities, including adult foster homes. I'm here to oppose this bill, basically for reasons that previous witnesses have already cited, but I just want to make a couple of points. First of all, no one really seriously questions the need for close scrutiny of an individual or of an industry that houses and cares for our most vulnerable citizens. Sometimes close monitoring will result in friction, especially when the business is operated in the provider's home. And I think that's a real problem. Providers have to acknowledge that when they go into business in their homes, they relinquish some of their privacy. In their ability to keep regulators out. I think that providers are, of course, entitled to fair treatment by regulators. And that's not the issue. The issue is whether this particular industry has any grounds for special treatment from regulators. It has received special treatment in a number of different areas. It doesn't have to provide workers' comp coverage, for example, and it has tax-free income from Medicaid. But it seems to be that this industry should be under the same scrutiny as other long-term care providers. No other industry of which I'm aware has its own Bill of Rights. And I think if we start to go down this road, I can't really see where it ends. This industry asks, on the one hand, to be treated as professionals, and certainly they're entitled to that treatment. But on the other hand, if they're going to ask to be professionals, it seems to me that they should not be able to carve out unprofessional exceptions when it's to their advantage to do so. Another point, several points I would make, is that it's really unclear what this bill would result in. If this bill were passed, the remedy that the provider, an aggrieved provider, would have would be to file a complaint with the agency. The bill doesn't really talk about what the agency does with that, and presumably the agency would get this complaint, it would have an investigation, and it would have to set up some kind of a process to deal with something that they're not dealing with now. I think that the agency is hard-pressed to provide adequate regulation to long-term care facilities with the staff it has now, especially in light of the cutbacks, and I think this bill would result in creation of another set of problems that they would have to investigate that is going to take their focus away from providing safe care for residents. I also think that there's some that as a result of this there would be some fiscal impact for them to create this new review process that seems to be contemplated under this, and it's really unclear what that would actually get the foster care providers. So for those reasons and the reasons that have been cited by previous witnesses, I would urge you to reject this bill.
Meredith?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And our agency promotes and protects long-term care facility residents' rights by identifying, investigating, and resolving their complaints and concerns. We're a non-regulatory agency, and we use a network of volunteers to engage in an informal process of complaint resolution. Our agency opposes House Bill 2519 for many reasons, many of them articulated by the speakers in opposition, and so I won't belabor that. There's no question that providers have rights. One of our primary concerns is that the vehicle for expressing those rights be a Bill of Rights that, as David indicated, no other provider has. And what it does is it puts it right up against the Residents' Bill of Rights, which, as other speakers have talked about, was basically created because so many residents in long-term care facilities view the fact that they've given up their independence, as also the fact that they've given up some of their basic rights as Americans. And so the statement of residence rights was created to empower them, and that despite a pervasive sense of loss, that that they still had some substantive rights. And it is for that reason that we oppose having a provider bill of rights as that same kind of vehicle. We also have specific concerns about many of the provisions of the Bill of Rights and how they are written, and some of the speakers have gone to that. But I'm going to talk about just the ones that affect the work of our agency. First of all, I have no problem with, and in fact, I think it is absolutely desirable that everyone show identification in the long-term care arena. There's a lot of people going back and forth. In fact, it is already part of the ombudsman statute under law that we show identification upon entry into a home. But what we do have some concerns about in the bill are specifically provisions 6, 7, and 10. And in provision six, beyond identification, it says to be advised of the reasons for the visit or contact. Under the ombudsman law, we have to protect the resident and the complainant when there is a concern or issue that emerged. In fact, we have to go out of our way, and it is incredibly difficult in these five-person homes where there's an intimate setting to always protect the resident when a complaint has been filed. So we're not in a position, in fact, to always express the reason for the visit. Under our statute and the rules that govern our agency, it talks about the rights of access of the ombudsman to do routine visitation and to investigate complaints. But we have to be very, very careful in not revealing complaints and the complainant and or the resident in a situation that could compromise potentially the safety or the confidentiality of that resident. In provision number 7, it says to be informed in writing at the initial contact or visit. First of all, we train volunteers. These are citizens in their communities that are giving of their time to be a community presence in long-term care facilities, to interact with residents, many of whom have no other contacts in their lives, and to require of these individuals to give a written report at an initial contact would violate not only the sort of the general tenets of this volunteer-driven program, but also, issues of confidentiality emerge. Finally, in provision number 10, to receive a written report describing all observations, conclusions, and recommendations not later than the 60th day after a visit. Although one could suggest that that might be directed more to the regulatory agency, the language is not clear on that. And again, we are not an agency that writes reports. We are a non-bureaucratic agency, and our main goal is to facilitate contact with residents and on an informal basis to investigate and resolve the issues that are important to them in their living environment. So all those provisions combined really are in conflict with both the ombudsman, both specific statutes and regulations of the ombudsman program, and also with the spirit of the ombudsman program. And so for those reasons and all of the other ones that have been articulated before me, we oppose House Bill 2519. Thank you.
Question.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I'm unclear why you're opposed to number 6, which would be shown identification by the ombudsman. Why would you oppose that?
No, in fact, I said that that's something that we do, and it's part of our statute. It's the back part of that that says to be advised of the reason for the visit or contact. That is the portion.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
I don't in any way, thank you, Mr. Chair, to indicate that I'm against protection of the patient. That's ultimately in my mind. But I worry a little bit when a provider can be assaulted and really not have much recourse to deal with that. There's something wrong. I think they need some rights as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, what I have passing acquaintance with the situation that was described by that provider. And although I agree with you, no provider should have to be assaulted. What I would say to you, if you want to learn more of that, there are more facts around that. It was an extremely complicated case. There was lots of back and forth on that case, and it is not as simple in terms of the outcomes as perhaps you would have discerned from that presentation. It was a very, very complex case, and you had a resident who sincerely wanted to spend time with her son. And as I indicated, if the representative would like to know more detail, we would be more than happy to convene the parties, because there was an element here that was not represented, and that was the investigatory agency, which we are not a part of, which was Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Services. And they also have a perspective on this particular case.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you for the follow-up. What I don't understand is why the middle agency or your people didn't recommend immediately that patient be moved to a place where she and her son would be happy and the provider would be happy. That's the solution.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that is not, I'll have to disagree. I don't think it's always the solution. When somebody goes into a long-term care facility, it becomes their home. What is difficult in the adult foster care arena is it's also frequently the provider's home as well. And so, but that person whose home it is, it's not easy to just say to that person, well, you're not getting along with the provider, your son's not getting along with the provider, you've got to find a new home. And what one has to try to do is figure out whether or not the situation can be resolved and remediated so that it can be workable for the provider and not infringe on their rights, but also so that that resident can enjoy the final days, hours, years of their lives in a home, in an environment that they call home. So I realize on the face of it, it's easier to say, if you don't like it, move on. But it isn't so simple when you're dealing with human lives and in those situations.
There's one other factor, and that is the other people in the home. And if you have information on that you'd like to give me, I'd welcome it. But it seems to me that if one patient is creating a major problem, whether it's a home or a medical practice or a dental practice or a veterinary practice, that the other people have to be considered as well, not only the provider but the other patients. And I would welcome any information you have on this. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I absolutely want to say that I agree with you, and that is always a factor, and I'm not sure whether that was a factor in this situation as to how the other residents might be affected by the conduct of any particular resident or their visitors. I agree with you wholeheartedly that has to be a consideration in how you assess a situation such as that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Sandy, I think there's legitimate things here, committee, and I think the issue is not so much between the adult foster care providers and their clients. The issue is more between the adult foster care providers and the agency that oversees them. And I think that's where the rights are. We will take Grover's suggested amendments into consideration. I'll have Sandy contact the appropriate people and see if we can come up with some reasonable compromise. And thank everybody for testifying, and we are adjourned.